Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Something happened on our program on Friday that may have caused Mayor de Blasio to speed up his timeline for acting on an integration plan for New York City public schools. We're not sure if an interaction with the mayor on Friday had this effect, but listen to this and you'll hear why we're wondering. On Thursday, there was a demonstration, mostly by students, at the DOE, or Department of Education, headquarters to call for more desegregation in the schools. And on our Ask the Mayor segment on Friday, one of the student leaders of that protest, a high school student, Tiffany from Brooklyn, called in, and the mayor greeted her.
Hey, Tiffany. How you doing today?
I'm doing well. So, since our meeting on May 17th, the 65th anniversary of Brown v. Board, with your cabinet, we have heard radio silence for over 20 days from your administration, which inevitably led to our protest yesterday. We had over 400 students and allies on the DOE steps yesterday representing over 100 high schools. Asian, white, black, Latinx, poor, rich students and supporters, and our message to you was, how much longer will it take? How much longer will it take before you make the choice to end the segregationist enrollment policies in our high schools, and how much more time do you need to study the issue?
So that was part of Tiffany's call. Here's part of the mayor's response.
Tiffany, with all due respect, and I do admire you as an activist, and you will be doing a lot of good in the world, and I hope you run for office one day as well, but I really think you're not hearing what we're saying to you, so I'll repeat it. There is a task force, an extraordinary task force, which I've met with, who are focusing on all the issues around diversity, include student members, who I think are doing a great job. They are coming forward with their next report in a matter of weeks.
In a matter of weeks, coming forward with their report in a matter of weeks. Well, what the mayor didn't mention there was that the advisory group had already issued 65 preliminary recommendations back in February. So that was Friday, and then boom, yesterday, the mayor and Chancellor Carranza embraced 62 of those 65 preliminary recommendations that have been out since Saturday. He didn't indicate that this was coming at all. And the mayor hadn't just said a matter of weeks once in the exchange we had on that. He came back to it to explain why he wasn't going to release the next round of the report immediately.
We have precisely 2 weeks to try and address it in Albany. That's where my attention is, because we have a chance to change something right now that we don't get to decide, but Albany does. And that's where I'm putting my energy. And that is called making priorities, because we have to change everything piece by piece.
So again, that was Friday. But then yesterday afternoon, there it was, the acceptance of the School Diversity Advisory Group reports 62 recommendations out of their 65, and the mayor and the school's chancellor, Richard Carranza, had a whole long press release ready to go, complete with endorsements from members of Congress, the state legislature, city council, at least one borough president, all after the mayor on Friday said this was weeks away and there had to be priorities. So what happened here? And let's, of course, most importantly, talk about the content. So we'll talk to one of the leaders of the advisory group right after we note that our caller, Tiffany from Brooklyn, was not satisfied with what the mayor and the chancellor came out yesterday with. She is Tiffany Torres, a leader in the group called Teens Take Charge, and she spoke to WNYC News yesterday.
Most of the words that they used were encourage and strongly support and consider, and there was no actionable step that the DOE can take to ensure that these plans work.
No actionable step? Well, we'll find out. With that, we are happy to have Maya Wiley to serve double duty, maybe triple duty. She's a member of the executive committee of the Mayor's School Diversity Task Force and was previously counsel to Mayor de Blasio. She is also chair of the Civilian Complaint Review Board, so maybe she'll have a comment on the CCRB's Daniel Pantaleo trial, now being completed in the death of Eric Garner. She's a professor of public policy and management at the New School and an MSNBC contributor, where she regularly analyzes issues around the Russia investigation, including yesterday's big development that Attorney General William Barr finally agreed to let the House Judiciary Committee see transcripts of testimony by witnesses cited in the Mueller report. So we're going to range from one I word to another, from integration to impeachment. And Maya, we really appreciate your time today in your very busy life. Welcome back to WNYC.
Thank you, Brian. It's a pleasure to be here. And I luckily actually don't have one of those roles anymore, although I enjoyed and loved that role, which is CCRB.
I actually stepped
down from the Civilian Complaint Review Board 2 years ago.
I apologize for being behind
no
the times
worries.
On that. Before we get into the content of the Diversity Advisory Group's report, did something get sped up over the weekend that you know of? Because the mayor said on Friday that the next action on this would be weeks away after he finishes lobbying the state legislature to do something at the state level. But boom, there it was yesterday.
So I really appreciate the question, but also more importantly, the discussion of our long-standing efforts in this city to make it more fair and inclusive for all of our students. And I really want to appreciate Tiffany, who is clearly fierce and an important leader. So here's the thing. Nothing new happened, and we knew in advance, well in advance. We met with the mayor and chancellor back in May, weeks before this press release, actually after the New York City Council hearings that we participated in on a series of proposed bills related to improving school integration. We knew at that point that the mayor and the chancellor were going to accept a large number of our recommendations. What had not happened was their completing their side-by-side to tell us, you know, going through a 118-page report, which ones they would and where they wanted to actually talk about it a little differently. Obviously, they're thinking about their larger constituency. We got that before, and we're having those conversations before that June 6th action that Tiffany was talking about and knew it was coming. In fact, we had had conversations with the Department of Education saying, why aren't we getting this announcement out before June 6th? Because that will make June 6th a very different conversation. And for a variety of reasons that the DOE should speak to itself, One is I was on vacation. They said, you've done so much work, we'd like you to be there. And I said, that's fine. I appreciate that. I don't have to be there. But I'm glad I was. So I would say, and I can't speak for the mayor, but knowing all the moving parts, I think several different things are getting conflated. One is we had a series of recommendations. They knew they were going to accept most of them. They didn't want to say that publicly until they could say publicly all of the recommendations they were accepting, which was soon to come. The second report that we are currently working on relates directly to gifted and talented programs and screens, system-wide. So I think the mayor was talking about that particular set of issues, given the way Tiffany's question was framed, and that he was focused on his own proposal that we did not participate in around specialized high schools. We didn't participate because we weren't included in that discussion, but we were also looking at system-wide, and the chancellor has, and the mayor have helpfully said, we are going to take swift action on those recommendations when we get them.
Okay, very clear. So there are 65 recommendations that the mayor and the chancellor adopted 62 of. We'll go over some of the most important ones and at least one big one that they didn't accept. But first, how would you state the problem? For some of our listeners who do not have their minds around this as an issue in New York City, how would you state the problem that your advisory group is seeking to solve?
I'm so glad you asked such good questions, Brian, because, you know, the problem that we are trying to solve is social mobility and social cohesion. You know, if we're really talking about what the roots of real integration are, it's how do we as a society move and grow together? How do we grow our economy? How do we attract businesses that want to be here because we have a workforce that knows how to work in diverse environments and in a global setting? How do we work together as citizens? You know, and by citizens, I'm not talking about a passport. I'm talking about members of society. All of the research shows that what real integration produces are both those things. Dropout rates go down, graduation rates go up for all students, white students, because we should call this out. You know, we so often talk about integration as if it's only for students of color and somehow white students lose. The reality of the research is it improves. White students who go to integrated schools do better in college, and they do better on two parameters. One is they more effectively interact with all the students in college who do not look like them. And the other is they take more advantages of the opportunities colleges and universities offer as a result of having gone to integrated schools before college. We should remember that. This is about benefiting every single one of our students. So what we're trying to do is take a system that was not built around social mobility and social cohesion and say, that's the system we have to build together.
What do you say to, I guess, predominantly white and maybe Asian parents who might say, I want my kids to be in a diverse environment, but because of history, disproportionately, the kids from the predominantly black and Latino neighborhoods are coming in not academically where our kids are, and that's going to hold my kids back if it's an academic diversity and this is only, we're only talking about it in terms of racial diversity.
So the first thing I would say is we completely understand many of us in the group are parents, many of us in the group are students, many of the group are people who have been in the New York City public school system as students. So we completely understand the fear. And part of what we recommended was, but rather than come from a place of fear, let's come from a place of fact. And some of those facts are, you know, that there is research that shows, and we need more research, but that there are benefits to ability grouping. The question is, what's the range and how do you do it and what kind of supports exist? But the other is, and we're seeing other districts, school districts start to experiment with this, Montgomery County, for example, is how do you create communities of interest? And, you know, we so often think about ability in all the wrong ways. You know, instead of thinking about ability of our interests, our talents, and what we all bring to the table when we come together, we think about sorting. And sorting becomes exclusion rather than identifying shared benefits. And so I think what we would say is part of the way we modeled our recommendation is we want to get there together. You know, this is not about a divisive conversation. This is about having a hard conversation that is inevitably embedded with some fears and saying, how do we work through those together?
One other conceptual question before we get into some of the specific recommendations of yours that the mayor adopted yesterday. People often use the word desegregation and integration interchangeably. Does the advisory group use them that way?
No. And we were very explicit in our report. And okay, our report's not the Mueller report. It is not 448 pages. It is, however, 118, which
are we going to have to issue a subpoena to get the underlying evidence?
Absolutely not. In fact, we put the underlying evidence in the report. By the way, Mueller did put a lot of that into. But just because I know you like the I words. But going back to the, we actually said desegregation is not the same thing as integration. In other words, we adopted what students told us, students like Tiffany. You know, we did a lot of listening. We had town halls in every single borough. We, part of our, the way we worked was saying we have to do this together and we have to listen to the communities that are impacted. We did it in every borough. One of the things we heard very, very clearly was, from students was, we think real integration is the five R's, and we adopted that framework. The five R's are, it is race and enrollment, but it's not only race and enrollment. It's resources, it's restorative justice, so we get out of criminalization of students of color that pushes them out of school. It's about relationships, meaning how are students and parents able to hold schools and the district and the DOE accountable and also have a more welcoming environment. And, you know, it's representation that also includes, you know, how does the system look like New York? So it's all those things,
so
and we took all those things.
So is that desegregation or is that
integration?
That's
real integration.
That's real.
So in other words, desegregation.
And that's the goal.
And that's the goal. And some of that is, you know, we have some districts that because of racial segregation, are segregated by housing. And, you know, therefore, obviously, that reproduces some of why our schools look the way they do. Not the only reasons, but some of the reasons. And, you know, part of what that means is those schools aren't automatically going to become racially different overnight. So resourcing has to go into those schools to support the academic achievement of those students, not to say, well, if you don't have white students in your building, oh, well, we're going to ignore you. No.
My guest is Maya Wiley, here primarily in her role as a member of the Executive Committee of Mayor de Blasio's School Diversity Task Force, 62 of whose recommendations the mayor officially embraced yesterday out of 65 that were made in February. And let me tick through for our listeners some of the recommendations from your group that the mayor and the chancellor did accept. The top four listed in order in their press release are: add metrics to the school quality report related to diversity and integration, create a general assembly with representatives from every high school to develop a citywide student agenda and vote on key issues. So that's a student general assembly, it sounds like. Tiffany will be happy about that.
Students asked for that, and we agreed.
Require all schools to monitor student discipline practices and develop a plan to reduce any disparities in how students are disciplined, and create new diversity targets for diversity in admissions, pilots based on the specific circumstances of each school community. So can you talk about numbers 1 and 4 there, adding metrics related to diversity and integration and creating diversity targets for diversity in admissions pilot programs? These are both about numerical measuring and goals, yes?
That's exactly right. And I think one of the things that's important to elevate out of our report and recommendations that is a game changer that the chancellor and mayor accepted is we said you weren't aggressive, and great that you came out in June 2017 with a plan to get 50,000 more students into racially representative schools. We also had a report from the Center for New York City Affairs, full disclosure, it operates out of my school. I did not work on that report with them, but
the new school.
But that report said, guess what? Demographic shifts will get 50,000 more students in racially representative schools. So that's actually not moving the goalpost. So we said, okay, fair enough. We have to be more aggressive with our goals. And we said the goals should be we plotted it out in kind of in short term, medium term, and long term. In the short term, we said schools, meaning 0 to 3 years, schools should look like their districts. Every single school in a district should look representative of its district. And then over 5 years, they should look like the borough, you know, and in 10 years, they should look like the city. And if the link to the metrics is, but how do you know if you're getting that done if you're not collectively reporting whether or not you're getting that done in a publicly transparent and clear way, so that if we're not doing it, if when we say to communities and to school districts, figure out how best you think you're going to achieve those goals, which is part of our philosophy, ground up, build it together, look at our districts because they're not all identical. It's not a one-size-fits-all strategy. But it has to be measured against the goal.
Another recommendation that they accepted is to strongly support and encourage the 9 districts with sufficient demographic diversity of population to develop diversity and integration plans. I think this is one that our teenage caller Tiffany was objecting to in the clip we played of her from yesterday, where she said, oh, they're using words like support and encourage. There's nothing actionable here. So what's actionable here?
Well, what's actionable here is grant money that supports the, in our recommendation, right? And my understanding is they accepted it. I think part of this is how do you summarize 62 recommendations clearly and effectively that are quite complex. That's so to be fair
right,
to the department
of page press
in a 4-page press release when you have a 118-page report. So that's a communication complexity. But what we said and what the DOE is supporting is start with the places that have no excuse. So we have districts that, and we've already seen it. You know, we have District 15, you know, Park Slope, Brooklyn. We have the Upper West Side. These are examples where there were very difficult conversations, but very much with community about what would improve admissions and make schools look more representative given what their districts look like. And the early results of those, you know, decisions are positive so far. You know, we need more information. But our point was build and expand that. You know, part of what the chancellor announced was 5 more districts that were going to be developing plans. But what we really said is those are the ones that have no excuse. Those are the ones that need to be invested in, but also held accountable to the goal.
We don't have a lot of time for phone calls in this segment, but let's get one or two in. Maria in Morningside Heights, you're on WNYC with Maya Wiley. Hi, Maria.
Yes, thank you for taking my call. And I actually was part of one of those diversity forums where I had the opportunity to meet briefly with Ms. Wiley and called her attention to the fact that Title I funding, and also the chancellor was there, I said the same thing to him. Title I funding is a big driver of the segregation that we see in the city schools. And what that means is the state has determined a school has to have a poverty rate of at least 60% to receive Title I funding. So it forces the city to corral lower-income students into schools so they can get that funding. And that's why you often see Title I schools near public housing projects, for instance. So unless that's changed, this problem, whether it's poverty or racial, is going to stay the same.
Right. Encourages concentration. And I see that's another one of the recommendations that was accepted, which was specifically to examine Title I and its relationship to integration. And again, as the caller states, Title I is federal funding for schools with a lot of low-income students, right?
Yes, and I thank you, Maria, for raising that point. We were explicit about needing to look at the resourcing based on Title I. We can debate whether or not the right way to think about it or the fact-driven way to think about it is that the Title I funding drives the segregation. I think there are many things that drive segregation. It is absolutely accurate to think about how important Title I funds are to supporting some of the resources we need for low-income students, and what's the impact if those resources somehow disappear. So we said we've got to look at that. We didn't have time to look at that, but again, that goes back to having an involved and community-based process intentional one.
Is there a better way to do it? Could the funding follow individual students based on their family situation, income, whatever?
Yeah, and I'm not a Title I expert, but I think the question becomes how much of it is a state policy level decision, how much of it is driven by how the federal government has structured the Title I program. But certainly there are as I understand it, the state has a lot of ways it can consider how to drive that funding. And yes, if it's following the student, then that means if the student's in a low poverty school, which is where we think we have to diversify socioeconomic status, we know that improves outcomes. That's something that has to be taken very seriously.
Adam in Queens, you're on WNYC with Maya Wiley. Hi, Adam.
Hi, Brian and Maya. Just wanted to talk about the word target versus quota. You know, if that's the relationship of the city being able to diversify the schools, then I guess it's not necessarily a dirty word. It may be a time for the city to do whatever it takes. And forget about merit and these kids earning high scores because their parents work hard and reinvest in their child's education. And they're going to school on Saturday, and they're investing like 30% as in the Asian American community that I'm in, where we just dump all of our money into our kid and rent and trying to survive here for that kid to have a better life. But why should he have opportunity to use his grades to get ahead? You know, he should really be subjected to people getting seats based on quotas instead.
You hear that. I think he's being a little passive-aggressive there,
well,
but you hear
I think
the skepticism
the
that he's
well,
coming
look,
from.
Well, look, I think this is a really important conversation to have, is that, you know, we have low-income parents of all different races, and certainly, particularly, we've seen a lot of really important activity in the Asian community, particularly low-income Asians, who are, as I think accurately stated, dumping huge amounts of very limited personal resources to get students to pass tests that are not deeply valid in terms of merit. And I think part of what we're saying is there are we have high schools where Asian students are underrepresented that are very high performing. And the question becomes, why are we burdening low-income families with pouring resources into admission standards that don't actually measure merit effectively?
And he's measuring merit by the way he described it, parental effort, and having their kids do things on Saturdays and so forth, and cited the Asian community that he said he comes from.
Yeah, and this is the point. I think part of what is wrong with the system is it tells people to use limited resources in ways that aren't the best developmentally for their children, and they aren't the best measures of merit. So no, these aren't quotas. Their goals. That's why there are community processes in our recommendations. We think it is critically important to engage with the Asian community, to engage with the Latino community, to engage with the white community.
What's the difference between a target and a goal? I mean, a quota and a goal.
The difference between a quota and a goal, and quotas are not constitutional, let's be clear. So the city is not legally permitted to do that. A quota says you absolutely must have the following number of people who look the following way in the following places. This is a goal, meaning we're saying the goal, the aspiration for the city that we should be measuring ourselves against and experimenting with in ways that serve all our students and serve their excellence is community by community, but with very clear goals, because the research tells us that's how all of our students actually get more opportunity.
This is WNYC FM HD and AM New York, WNJT FM 88.1 Trenton, WNJP 88.5 Sussex, WNJY 89.3 Netcong, and WNJO 90.3 Toms River. We are New York and New Jersey Public Radio, with just a few minutes left, with Maya Wiley here primarily as a member of the Executive Committee of Mayor de Blasio's School Diversity Task Force. The mayor and the school's chancellor, Richard Carranza, accepted 62 out of their 65 recommendations that they had released in February yesterday. Maya Wiley is also professor of public policy and management at the New School and an MSNBC contributor, where she regularly analyzes issues around the Russia investigation. And if I can pivot to that for our remaining couple of minutes, I saw you on MSNBC last night on Attorney General William Barr agreeing finally to let Congress see some underlying evidence or testimony that fed the Mueller report. Why do you think he caved, and what in those materials might matter to anything?
Well, Brian, while I can't read William Barr's mind, what I believe happened is he said, this doesn't serve my optics. Ultimately, I have not a lot of strong legal reason to withhold them ultimately. And what do we gain in the short run? Because it just looks like we're hiding. I suspect he's going to go through a process that will be very lengthy in deciding what to release, when and how, and that's going to be one of the things that Chairman Nadler's going to be pressing on. But I think it was the right decision. I'm glad he made it, and I think it was a win for Nadler as well.
And with your understanding of both politics and the law, what are we heading for here, and when will we be likely seeing impeachment proceedings and the heart of the 2020 presidential campaign at exactly the same time?
I don't know. What I would say we are heading towards, I think we're already, you know, despite everyone avoiding the word, the Congress is investigating now. You can call them impeachment proceedings or not, but the reality is it is the information gathering that's going to inform whether or not they want to formally call it impeachment. And I think what's important for the American people is that they get the facts.
What do you think the trigger is or should be for the House? It's really Nancy Pelosi, I think, who's really driving what they call it and the pace of things, in addition to, of course, the legal process and the resistance to allowing testimony and allowing documents get out. That's also driving the timing. But Pelosi is also, I think, being very strategic in what she wants to allow when, and some people disagree with the strategy that she's using. When does it, what would trigger it as you analyze what Pelosi is doing, and when, in your opinion, should it be triggered to call it an official impeachment inquiry?
Well, Pelosi has made very clear, and she's a very smart legislator and a very shrewd leader, that she's looking both for the American public to believe it's appropriate and the possibility of conviction in the Senate. And I think that's the conundrum. And I think what really changes it is whether or not bringing more of these facts to light, unraveling the false narrative, frankly, that William Barr very effectively spun when the Mueller report first came out, whether the American public, and we've already seen when Mueller came forward and spoke, even though all he did was say what the summary of his report, that already there was an uptick in the polling. So I think the polling itself, but that's why I think it's critically important that the House get the facts out.
Maya Wiley from the New School and Mayor de Blasio's Diversity Task Force, thank you so much for spending this time, and let's keep these important conversations going. Thank you.
Thank you so much for having me.